Welcome to the Big Mike Fun Podcast, where you learn about advanced wealth building strategies from real estate investing to creating massive ROI and secure retirement profits. So pour yourself a cup of coffee, grab a notepad, and lean in. Because Big Mike has got the mic, starting now.
Welcome to the Big Mike Fun Podcast. I'm the Big Mike.
Mike Zlatnik. Today it is my pleasure and a privilege to welcome Selina Kulkarni. Hi, Selina.
Hey, Mike. Awesome to be here. Thanks for having me.
Thank you kindly again for joining. Selina is joining us from the land down under, from Australia. Or maybe we are the land down under and you are the...
You know, you guys are the land way up there.
So big time difference. And Selina is a great friend. We met through Freedom Founders, and she is the founder and the CEO of the Freedom Warriors, right? That's another mastermind. So tell folks a little bit about you, the Freedom Warriors, and let's start with you, your family, kids, cats, pets.
Thanks, Mike. Ah, that's a big question. So yeah, my name is Selina Kulkarni. I live in Canberra, Australia. A lot of people don't realize that that is in fact the capital of Australia. I have a husband and two teenage boys who are awesome, and a small dog, Coconut, or Coco. And I trained as an accountant, so my love and foray into the world of investing was a pretty natural progression, some might say. A natural application of my skill set. But I definitely felt like I was a round peg in a square hole when I was working for Deloitte. That did not feel like a fit for me. And so my journey has been one around exploring, where are some more creative outlets and applications of someone with reasonable number skills. And eventually I, forayed into investment about 20 odd years ago, and particularly real estate here in the Australian market. And, one thing just led to another, and things snowballed. And I think it was in 2009, I had been fairly aggressive with the investing that we had done here, but I hit a wall. The banks kind of turned around and said, in the middle of global financial crisis, no more. And it was one of my strengths would be I've got pretty good grit, and I'm pretty determined. So I started to just say, well, what else? And the what else led me to start exploring other markets and other opportunities, and that's how I connected with the States. And my foray into the world of alternative, I've never looked back. So yeah, it's been about 12 years now since I first started investing over there.
That's great to hear, and thank you for the history and the family. So the follow-up question, I love Coco, by the way. I like the name. I know a few guys named Coco, and it's kind of funny. I know another guy that has a dog named Coco, and I know a guy whose name is Coco, so it's...
That's amazing. I don't know any humans with that name. I know lots of dogs with that name. She was meant to be a Coco Chanel, but she's just a mutt, so she's a coconut.
Yeah, I know Coco. He's a good friend in my California investor mastermind, Living Alone. I'm not going to go beyond that, but his name is Coco. He's originally Armenian. I don't know, maybe it's an Armenian name, but let's go into real estate. So how do people invest or have been investing in real estate, or we call it property investing in Australia? In some ways, we chatted, it resembles investing in the United States in a big city environment. People invest for growth and negative cash flow, right? Just talk a little bit about this and what's different, at least in your understanding, in the United States.
Well, interestingly, just some context to start with. As a nation, we are absolutely obsessed with property and real estate here. We have multiple magazines. We have countless media sources, articles, news. It features in the news all the time. So as a nation, per capita, we are extremely hungry around the topic of real estate investing. The challenge is that, you know, partly because we're so far away from the rest of the world, our definition of what is standard is very different to what the rest of the world does. And it isn't until you have the, I guess, the courage to look elsewhere and explore other opportunities that you even realize that there's a whole world of investing that we just know nothing about. And as you pointed out, our market is one where the metrics around the price of real estate relative to the income that you can earn would be seen as completely out of whack. And I think you and I have talked about it being probably most similar to the New York market. But effectively, the way things work here in Australia, and there are some exceptions, but it's very hard to invest in Australian real estate for cash flow. The main purpose of real estate for wealth creation, and it's just accepted as normal wisdom, is you buy a piece of property, you tolerate the negative or shitty cash flow, and in 10, 15, 20, 30, 40 years, maybe you can hope that that asset will deliver you some sort of paltry net return of 1 to 2.5%. That's the average. That's the norm.
Wow, that's crazy. I mean, what kind of cap rate these things trade at? So in other words, if you, in residential real estate, you know, people don't use the cap rate term, but in commercial they do. So what kind of, you know, you write $1 million check into a property. Let's just say there was no mortgage for the minute. And what kind of net operating income would a property generate on $1 million investment in Australia in just annual cash flow without the mortgage?
I'd say if you were getting 2%, that would be on the higher side.
That's a 2% cap rate. That's crazy. Oh, that's why if you get a mortgage, and what kind of rates people get when they get a mortgage?
Look, to be honest with you, there used to be quite a discrepancy between the interest rates that you guys had in the States and what we had here in Australia, like a few percentage points different. Since maybe the global financial crisis and even COVID, the rates have become more aligned. So, you know, if you're really doing well as a mum and dad owning their own home, you might have something at the high ones at the moment. But typically between 2 to 3.5% is kind of where things sit right now. So pretty similar to the States is my
understanding. On a 30-year mortgage.
Well, no, let me clarify. We don't do fixed rate loans for 30 years the way that you guys have them in the States. The most we can fix our interest rates for is up to 5 years.
So it's a variable, five-year fixed, and after that it floats.
You can choose to refix, but yeah, that's kind of the limit. So yeah, there's so many goings on inside of the States that you guys take for granted that I look at and I'm just incredulous. You guys have phenomenal loopholes in the tax system, phenomenal incentives around investing, and phenomenal cash flow. It's amazing.
Well, it's different, right? So for sure, US, it's one of the most advantaged asset classes for many reasons. People invest in real estate because of all the benefits, the leverage, the free, you know, not the free, but the cheap financing, depreciation, accelerated depreciation, obviously a number of other benefits. But your rates are pretty competitive. I mean, if they're below 2% and people are buying at 2% cash on cash, I mean, that explains it, right? So the mortgage rates and then the cap rates, they're pretty close. And it's kind of similar to a big city investing. Sometimes the cap rate is actually below the mortgage rate. Then you have negative leverage. I mean, that all the cash for every dollar you borrow is costing you more than you're getting in cash in terms of the debt service. But that aside, it's almost fascinating. People have so much interest in real estate, and the returns in Australia are, you know, they're not that great. Maybe you don't have anything else to invest in and a lot of cash, and people choose it because it feels safe. But we talked about negative cash flow. So what's a typical, when folks get a mortgage and then they invest, what do they deal with? 3-4% negative cash flow, and they're hoping for, you know, 5-7% appreciation. Is that the play?
Yeah, look, the challenge at the moment is an interesting one. the, you know, the market, as you guys are probably experiencing there, is very frothy here. So there's a lot of people who are purchasing property in a frenzied way, chasing deals, things like that. And part of the issue, though, that goes with those low interest rates is that, and I, you know, I saw it at a auction the other day. I don't know if you have them, house auction, where everybody turns up to the front of the house and there's an auctioneer who, you know, basically sells it to the highest bidder. And there were a bunch of young couples there who clearly, you know, they had their check for the 10% deposit on the day. But because interest rates are so low, the banks have turned around to a lot of people and said, well, actually, your borrowing ceiling is higher than it was a year ago. And so what's happening is there's a lot of people going out and purchasing real estate for more than they could afford a year ago because interest rates are so low. But unfortunately, that then saddles them with much higher debt. And quite right, what an investor is hoping for is a reasonable level of capital growth every year, year on year, that will, you know, years ago, like 20 years ago, people would hope that real estate would double every 7 years. Nowadays, I don't know that that expectation is quite as strong. And you know, 20 years ago, as probably was the case in the US, you could throw a dart at the map of Australia and you would probably do okay. Whereas now, because our market, our real estate market has become so efficient, it's really hard to find the diamonds in the rough. So, you know, that's another thing. The market in the States is so much less efficient, which means your capacity to piggyback and joint venture with a lot of locals means you can find plenty of great deals. Over here, it's really tough. It's like every man and their dog is looking for good deals.
That's really fascinating. So thank you for for those thoughts. So my quick comment, it's happening here too. I mean, the United States is on fire and a lot of bidding wars. And I mean, auctions typically take place, foreclosure auctions, but there are very few now with the forbidden foreclosures. Rarely ever do I see an auction on a property, but there's a sort of an equivalent when there's a listing of a hot property within, you know, the open house weekend. You get 10 offers over the asking price and they're bidding up the price against each other. And you're right, the affordability has gone up with lower interest rates. So the same level of salary can buy you, you know, a bigger mortgage because of lower interest rates. So that's been kind of the case here as well. People effectively overpaying, they even know that they're overpaying, but they don't have a choice. It's a limited supply. The big problem, actually, I had it in the last month's newsletter. No, this month just came out. We talked about why is the freaking market on fire? No supply. You got no supply. You have, you know, normally you want to see 3 to 6 months worth of supply in the market, but it's 3 weeks, 2 weeks in most markets. It's crazy. When you have no supply, people just overbidding like crazy if they want to win the property. The rational thinking goes away. And this is problematic in the long run. And the rapidly appreciating market can be a runaway train. The affordability will quickly collapse because people's salaries are not going up as fast as these prices. So the danger zone is when the market overheats and affordability gets bad. Again, how is affordability measured, right? It's the average price of a property relative to the average salary in a given area. And the mortgage rates is sort of what creates that affordability. So as interest rates have been climbing, salaries don't go up as much and the prices of real estate goes up, affordability goes down quickly. And when people can't afford it, that's a big issue. I mean, it's yes. Essentially, it becomes almost like a ceiling on future growth. And I mean, it kind of reverts to the mean at some point. That's the danger. So now let's switch a little bit. So U.S. investing obviously has very different flavors, so many flavors. And like you said, the market is not as efficient as Australian market. It's more fragmented market. and there are more opportunities to find sort of better deals. Although it's gotten harder lately with technology and everything else. But what do you, you know, what do you, your folks invest here in the States? What do they like? What kind of deals? What kind of opportunities? You know, we were fortunate that some of your members invested with us in our family of funds. So I appreciate that. And that becomes, you know, one of the options because we offer diversified funds. But as far as specific deals, what do you, your folks like? Do they like turnkey properties? Do they like self-storage projects? Do they like, what's the Australian view on US opportunities and what they've been investing in recently?
Well, first I would say that I would argue that a teeny tiny fraction of the population are even aware that there are very stable, predictable investments which can be accessed outside of Australia. A couple of people kind of dabble in New Zealand property, but the vast majority wouldn't have a clue. And so from my perspective, what we're doing inside of Freedom Warrior would be considered definitely outside the norm in the Australian market. In terms of what my guys in our tribe like to look at in the States, they really are getting the benefit of me having it done all the wrong ways all these years. When I started investing in the States, I was trying to do it myself. You know, I made several trips there. I bought properties based on price. I looked at the pro formas and the profit and losses and, you know, made some pretty silly decisions in retrospect. But, you know, I got lots of cuts and bruises. I didn't lose my shirt, but I learned the hard way that if I'm going to have access to the best of the best deals, it is very foolish for me to be out there trying to find the deals myself. Now, I know that, you know, the way that I have taught the strategy inside of my own group, we have the five broad buckets of, you know, strategies. You've kind of named them. But ultimately, I think if you want to really tip the scales in your favor and have good downside protection, you have to be finding the people who have access to the best opportunities in the market, who have a proven track record, who are ethically sound, and who are boots on the ground working day in, day out at a grassroots level so that they can take a pulse on what's happening in the market. So I personally have no biases to or against any particular strategy. My goal is to create an environment which is about empowering our investors, our group, to be educated in the decisions that they make to maintain a high degree of control. And so for me, working with people like yourself is a no-brainer. You know, my goal is I tell everyone, like, for no other reason, you should be investing with Mike because you will learn a lot about how to look over the shoulder of a professional investor. And, you know, from my perspective, I'm all about downside protection. And, you know, there are many layers of how you do good due diligence. But if I layer my, you know, my due diligence over the top of your due diligence, that's like a double safety net from my point of view. So we love the private funds, syndications, turnkey, all of those deals are great, provided you can partner with and find the right person to support your investor journey. If you are looking up people on Google and you don't know them from a bar of soap, I just think that's a recipe for coming undone at some point. And that's not how a professional investor would behave.
Lots of great nuggets. Thank you, Selena. I really enjoyed that last comment. And I just wanted to say a couple of things in relation to that. I mean, that's, we share the same philosophy. You always have to start with people. Know, like, and trust them. And until that happens, it's very difficult to invest. So unless you're investing into some kind of institutional, really big company, then you're relying on a name. But if you're investing with people, you're picking individuals and their teams and their organizations and relationships. And that's a starting point. That it you know, it's a part of a safety net. It's not guaranteed that everything will go smoothly, but it's a great safety net. And the other thing you mentioned, that you got cuts and bruises from the investing. I have a good question to ask. And this question, there's a crux of the wisdom in this question. So I think you were answering it in, you know, you can make a guess of what, based on the question, what you were doing. So are you learning to invest or investing to learn?
Ah, that is a great question. Behind every loss, if you don't have the capacity to find the lesson and the wisdom so that you never make that mistake again, I think that it's kind of like running a race with one arm behind your back. You've got to find the wisdom. I coach people around money. And one thing I know for sure is that if you have undigested pain around past losses, it's very hard to break through to that next level of investing, you know, evolution. I think being an investor is really about continuing to evolve. And I think anyone who says they've never made a mistake is maybe either hasn't taken big enough risks, or maybe they just haven't learnt the lessons. But yeah, look, I hope I don't make too many more monumental mistakes as I have done in the past. You know, I've made some good ones. I think my investing education, for sure, has cost hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Yeah, all of us. And that question, there's no right answer. And the reason I asked the question, because most people, they invest to learn initially. I mean, they basically, they make investments and then they learn as a result, right? You learn from your mistakes. So that's kind of it. It's the path of when you don't know enough, you still invest and then you learn from the investment. Yeah. The other way is when you're investing to learn, you're learning to invest is when you don't take the steps, but you kind of prepare. And folks, when they join your program, that's what they're doing. They're basically learning to invest before they invest. And it has the benefit of you giving them the education and the safety and of some of the, you know, better sponsors here and operators and fund managers. So I think it's a very powerful concept. And I mean, it's scalable. At the end of the day, that's the way the world goes around. Well, for sure. And you comment, you know, you're looking, you know, who to invest in on Google or Facebook. You know, I mean, that's a recipe for a complete collapse. There's so many promoters, shiny objects, scammers, idiots. For sure, you can't even go there. And for every good deal, there are 10 really crappy deals. And yeah, I mean, good luck with that if you're going to make a decision to invest based on the most attractive offering out there that's, you know, promoted. What's really interesting...
I'd love to add to that though, Mike. I think one of the things that I think has been a bond between us is we're both striving to be good practitioners of our art versus being good marketers. And sometimes I look at the world around me and I see it's full of these people who are just amazing at the marketing, and they've got very little behind them in terms of substance as a practitioner. And so I think the journey that you and I are on is we're great practitioners, and we're learning how to articulate our message in lots of ways. And the podcast is awesome, Mike. So congratulations on that. But yeah, I think one of the things that really attracted me to you in the beginning was the authenticity around how you speak. You don't sugarcoat anything. You know, there's no sell. And I really love that.
Yeah, thank you again. That last piece. It's just that's the truth. If people ask me, I suck at marketing. I can't put it any other way. I'm terrible at this, and I'm trying to find better people than me to help lead our marketing, for the reason that not my natural talent, nor even a learned trait. And we all gravitate to do something good, and we can't be jack of all trades, unfortunately. But there are a lot of brilliant marketers. What's really interesting, you know, I sit and observe this. People offer crappy products with great marketing, and they win over better products with crappy marketing. I mean, this is how the world goes around. Marketing drives. Yep. But it is what it is. And in the really long run, eventually, the best investing strategy and the best investing manager wins. But in the short run, kind of, you know, the marketing wins. But let's switch, just chat a little bit about somewhat, you know, different. So you have an event coming up and you have this great idea, Velocity of Money. I'm going to touch on this a little bit. It's kind of early. so let's just talk about Velocity of Money. How do you understand Velocity of Money in your view? And what do you like, dislike? How does it apply to Australia? Any just quick thoughts? Because I know it's a hot topic and you're going to run a whole mastermind on this. I love the topic, Velocity of Money. It's really cool. So any thoughts, comments there?
Look, I think one of the lessons I've learned over time is this idea that the more proactive you can be around the management of your money and the faster you can turn it over and take returns and reinvest, that's when you start to do really interesting things and 10x your results. If you are someone who just wants to put their money into something and forget about it and rely on the principle of compound interest, that's great. And you know, you'll probably do very well over time. For those people who, you know, I share openly, I've never earned a great income out of a corporate job. Like, I think my highest salary in corporate was about $80,000 20 years ago. And so I've never had the luxury of super high income as many, you know, people in corporate America and other business owners have had. And so I've had to really lean into the creative aspect of building wealth. And the concept of velocity of money is really that the more you can speed up the way that your money proactively is used to grow wealth versus the passive way, which is buy an asset, hold, and hope for capital appreciation, has really been the single greatest contributor to our success in our family. And that takes a little bit of steel in terms of, you know, you got to double down and learn and be active. But I just knew that, you know, the old traditional approach just wasn't going to cut it. So velocity of money for me is an important concept if time is valuable to you.
Yeah. Great thoughts. Velocity of money, if you figure out what works and you can rotate it again and again and again, repeat what works, you could accelerate your capital growth because you know, it's kind of funny. I'm going to go back to the good old days. We did this at the early days of the boom and bust, you know, right after 2008, talking about velocity of money. And we did some transactional funding, kind of the ultimate velocity of money. And it's a little different type, but I'm going to bring it up. We don't do much of it today. This was many years ago. What was really fascinating, we're funding flips and people are borrowing money for 1, 2, or 3 days. They would buy a house today, close, and then immediately sell. They have a buyer lined up to flip the house. So when they were flipping the house, they didn't need money for long. They just needed the money to close and then to resell. And it's funny, we charged them, you know, 1.5, 2 points for a closing. It's like a hard money. You charge 2 points, you're done. But imagine you're repaid 3 days later and you do it again and again. And if you can rotate the money 4 or 5 times a month, could make really, this was an example of ultimate. It's not like this. I wish it was like this today, but you can't rotate your money making 2% a month. 4 or 5 times a month. It's a short-lived opportunity. Very quickly it ran out. But when it worked. Velocity of money was you know, that was an extreme case of that velocity of money. But today, in my view, velocity of money is identifying opportunities that you can do value at work, increase the value of the asset, and instead of holding it for 5 years, sell it. So if you can, you know, double your money every couple of years, I mean, that's great. You know, that's sort of your ultimate acceleration. The slow pace is, you invest and you buy and hold. That slow pace actually works. when you have a lot of money. It's kind of funny how it works. It's if you're solving a big money problem, you're no longer trying to maximize the return. You're trying to deploy the money and get some kind of a yield. If you're solving a smaller money problem, you got to get your money working. That's velocity of money matters. So, and again, small money versus big money doesn't mean it's a small amount of money. It's just relative to the opportunities, right? So if you're solving a $1 billion problem, you got to get the money working. If you're solving, a $10, $20 million problem, it's a very different type of an exercise. It's a lot easier to put it to work. So,
yeah, look, I think everything you've said is 100% true. And what I would also add is that the traditional wisdom here in Australia, New Zealand has been buy an asset, let it compound, and never sell it, ever.
Well, if you found yourself a great deal, Warren Buffett, right? It's basically if you value invest into something and you buy it and you bought it really the real estate in the right location, and then it's appreciating at certain 10% a year, and you have leverage on that. With leverage, you're compounding at 20% a year. Here's your Warren Buffett, 50 years later, 20% 50 years. He's the richest man, in the Babylon. So it's
Look, it's the I think it's better than nothing. It's definitely better than nothing, and certainly if you want to build your net worth, that strategy is very valid, and it's playing the long game, which is important. But I think if you're the sort of business owner or individual that likes the idea that you don't have to wait till you're 65 to start, leading the life you love and that you want to do other things, then you have to embrace velocity of money.
I agree. That's well said. Thank you. All right. Final thoughts. We are kind of running towards, as they say, all good things must come to an end. And so does this podcast. So episode. So is there an advice, any new book you've read, maybe the book you've written, maybe some other thoughts? Kind of anything interesting to share with the audience?
Yeah, look, I'll share this. I've just finished reading Shoe Dog. And it is basically the autobiography written in a story format by the founder of Nike. And I just happened to download it onto my Kindle. But the reason I'm sharing this, it was such an entertaining read. It was such a great read. And I think it encapsulates the concept of velocity of money really beautifully. And I'm going to be sharing some of that at my upcoming event. But if you're looking for an entertaining, easy read, if you want to understand entrepreneurialism on steroids and how people, we can look at Nike and think, oh my God, they're a giant. They must have always been that way. But, they lived on a knife's edge for the first 10 years of their history. And I think it's a great read. So from an investor point of view, from a business point of view, and if you want to really kind of see the concept of velocity money in practice, I think it's a great read.
Thank you for sharing. That was wonderful. Final thoughts, if people wanted to reach out, if somebody is listening from Australia and they would like to get into your mastermind, how would they... what's a website? How do they reach out and ask questions and get the conversation going?
Well, as most people are, I'm on all the socials, so people can find me on LinkedIn and Facebook. And then if they want to check out the website, it's freedomwarrior.com.au.
Got it. Thank you kindly, Selena. Always a pleasure to have you and really appreciate coming on the podcast. I think you came before, you're here now. We're going to do it again.
I love it, Mike. Thanks for having me.
Thank you kindly.
Thank you for listening to the Big Mike Fund Podcast. To receive your copy of Mike's How to Choose a Smart Real Estate Fund book, head to bigmikefund.com or visit Amazon and type Mike's slot name. Keep listening and keep investing, Big Mike style. See you on the next episode.